Hello, this is Owen Bennett-Jones, and thanks for downloading the interview. My guests today have written an article and a subsequent book saying that the Israel lobby has a stranglehold on the US Congress and is so strong that it's jeopardizing US security. Professors John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt from Chicago and Harvard Universities. I hope you enjoy listening. Well, first of all, thanks very much for talking to us on the interview.
Very nice to be here.
Our pleasure.
And Professor Mearsheimer, let me start with you and just, first of all, get you to outline your position on this issue. And you really start by saying that the US government offers Israel more support than it does to any other country.
Our argument is that the United States has a special relationship with Israel that has no parallel today or in the history of the United States. We give Israel huge amounts of economic and military aid. We defend it diplomatically in the United Nations all the time. And very importantly, we do it unconditionally. No matter what Israel does in terms of its foreign policy behavior, that assistance to Israel continues.
Just so people can distinguish your voices, that's Professor Mearsheimer from the University of Chicago and Professor Walt from Harvard. Can you put some numbers on that?
$3 to $4 billion per year, which works out to $500 per year for every Israeli citizen. And this, by the way, even though Israel is a rather prosperous country now with a per capita income that's 29th in the world, it's not a poor country like Bangladesh. So it's quite sizable amounts of support now.
Right. I think to say that there is a very close U.S.-Israeli relationship is not controversial. So to move it one stage further, why, Professor Walt, do you think this level of support is offered?
Well, it's often said that this is because Israel's a strategic asset or because it's a democracy. But as we lay out in the book, those arguments can't explain why we give it so much help. There are many democracies in the world, but none of them has this special relationship. And we argue that it's primarily due to the political influence of the Israel lobby, a group of organizations and individuals, both Jewish and non-Jewish, that work openly within the American political system to encourage a very strongly pro-Israel position.
Professor Mearsheimer, let me put it to you that there are other reasons than it being a democracy. It's a loyal ally in a difficult part of the world and an important part of the world with a lot of oil resources, and there are moral reasons for supporting Israel.
Well, there are moral reasons for supporting the survival of Israel. And we make it very clear in the book that the United States should be committed to Israel's survival and should come to its defense if its survival is in jeopardy. But one cannot make a moral case for the present relationship. For example, some people say that Israel shares our values. But in fact, if you look at what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians in the occupied territory, if you look at what they did in Lebanon in the summer of 2006, their behavior is hardly consistent with American values.
Now, you go further, the two of you, in writing this book. You say not only does this relationship exist, but that it is on occasion against American interests, and that the U.S. government itself acts against its own interests. Professor Walt, how can that be? Give us an example.
Well, all governments do things that are occasionally quite foolish, but the fact is that unconditional support for Israel, as John has just described, undermines America's standing around the world. It certainly is one of the reasons we have a terrorism problem, not the only reason by any means, but one of the critical reasons. It was clearly part of the motivation behind the September 11th attacks. Again, not the only motivation behind it. It makes America's relations with its other allies somewhat more difficult, makes it harder for us to win support. And we argue throughout the second half of the book that in a number of key cases, the invasion of Iraq, our policy towards Iran, our support for Israel during the war in Lebanon that John just alluded to. In each of these cases, we undermined America's strategic position, not because we were supporting Israel's right to exist, but because we were backing Israeli policy regardless of what it did.
Professor Mearsheimer. Yeah,
regarding the question of why the lobby is able to wield so much influence on American foreign policy, it's important to understand that small interest groups have always wielded significant policy in the United States because interest group politics have been at the heart of the American political system since the founding of the country. And if you look at organizations like the National Rifle Association, the Farm Lobby, the Cuban Lobby, what you see is that small numbers of well-organized, well-financed, and smart people can influence policies in ways that are not always in the American national interest.
How do you define the Israeli lobby?
We define it as a loose coalition of individuals and organizations that works openly. It's not clandestine or secretive. Works openly to shape American policy. It includes groups like AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the Anti-Defamation League, Christian evangelical groups like Christians United for Israel. This is a heterogeneous coalition that doesn't agree on everything, and it's certainly not a cabal or a conspiracy. What all of these groups agree on, however, is trying to maintain that special relationship between the United States and Israel, where Israel basically isn't criticized by American politicians and gets consistent American backing regardless of what its policies are.
And how does it work on your account, Professor Meir Seimer? What does it do to get its ideas across into policy?
Well, it does basically two things. One is that it directly influences the policymaking process in Washington, D.C. It lobbies on Capitol Hill. It puts pressure on American presidents to pursue specific policies. It places individuals who are closely attached to Israel inside the American administration in a very open way, mind you. That's the first way that it affects outcomes. And the second way that it affects outcomes is by influencing the discourse in the United States about Israel. It goes to great lengths to make sure that there are no opinion columns or editorials in major newspapers that are critical of Israel or critical of the U.S.-Israeli relationship. And when individuals like Steve and I come along who talk about the lobby and its negative influences, they go to great lengths to silence us or at least to marginalize us.
And just to emphasize, this is something which a lot of lobbies do. I mean, they all try and get their own pieces in the newspapers and to try and put off other people from writing pieces and to influence congressmen and using money. Obviously, all the lobbies do this.
As we like to say, what the Israel lobby is doing is as American as apple pie.
Right.
With one exception, which is not a tactic that most lobbies use, and that is the smearing of critics. One of the things that some groups, not all, but some groups in the Israel lobby do is attack anyone who's critical by accusing them of being anti-Semitic. This is a tactic designed to marginalize people, make them seem like they're extremists. It also deters people from raising any criticisms, because who wants to be labeled with a horrible accusation like that? And so for both of those, and finally, it distracts people, right? You start debating whether or not you're an anti-Semite rather than talking about what's really important, which is U.S. policy. And that's not really a legitimate tactic.
Well, you certainly have been both accused of being anti-Semitic, and we'll talk about this aspect of your story now, because you first wrote this book was in its first point was an article.
Yes.
And you were writing it for an American journal called Atlantic Monthly, and it didn't get published. Now, why was that?
Well, we believe that the Atlantic Monthly got cold feet at the end and decided not to run with the article. We thought all along that they liked what we had written and that they would ultimately publish it. But it's our belief that in the end, they saw the article as too controversial. Their basic assessment of how the piece would be received, I think, was correct. They understood that it was nitroglycerin in the American context, and it's no accident that the piece was eventually published across the Atlantic Ocean here in London by the London Review of Books. But in the age of the Internet, a piece published in London is not much different than a piece published in New York, because it quickly ricochets all around the world. So as soon as that piece came out in the London Review of Books, it was in the mailboxes, the email boxes of huge numbers of people inside the United States.
That's right. There was an amazing figure for the number of downloads. It was sort of 250,000 downloads or something like that.
Yeah, there was also a fully footnoted version, fully referenced version that was put up on the faculty website at the Kennedy School where I work. And as of a month or so ago, I think there had been 385,000 downloads of that particular paper, which we both found completely astonishing that there was that much interest. I don't think we would have predicted that beforehand.
Your other articles, Dan? Quite get this.
No, I don't think so.
Why two authors?
Because I thought that no one individual could withstand the firestorm that would ensue.
Your piece went out, as you say, it's on the London Review of Books, it's on the Harvard Kennedy School webpage, everyone's reading it. Was there a firestorm?
Well, yes. There was immediate protests from a variety of quarters. People began to make public accusations. There was an op-ed published very quickly after it in the Washington Post with the title, Yes, It's Anti-Semitic. A number of other people quickly weighed in with similar accusations of various kinds in a number of particular venues. There was lots of attention being paid to it, and most of it initially was quite hostile and quite personal. We anticipated this, not every detail. There were obviously some attacks that took funny directions.
For example?
Well, the New York Sun, for example, contacted David Duke. David Duke had never heard of us. David Duke is the former head of the Ku Klux Klan. He's notoriously anti-Semitic. And they called him and asked him what he thought of us and essentially got his endorsement and then trumpeted that we were, of course, being endorsed by this complete extremist.
It's guilt by association.
Right. Even though, of course, we don't believe and stand for any of the things that he stands for, and made that clear throughout our work. So we did face an immediate firestorm. The good news was that shortly thereafter, within a couple of months, we saw the tide begin to turn. Some more reasonable voices started weighing in, defending us in a variety of ways, and we felt like we were starting to get a serious conversation.
Professor Mearsheimer, was this just at a public level, you know, op-ed articles, people talking on the radio and the television, or was it your colleagues coming to you and saying, what are you doing?
No, that didn't happen. I think if you wanted to describe the reaction in the United States in a rather simple form, I think what happened was that we really were clobbered in the mainstream media, as we expected would be the case. But when we went around and talked to people about the article, and this has certainly been true with the book as well, what we find is that the vast majority of people are thrilled that we wrote the book and they want to talk about this subject. We get very little criticism. We get some, but very little criticism when we go talk to audiences.
Are you Jewish?
No, neither of us.
Neither of us.
And do you think it would have helped if you were?
It wouldn't have mattered. No.
There are a number of people who are Jewish who have been critical of Israel and critical of the lobby in the past. A good example would be Tony Jutt, the historian who is at NYU. And he's been quite viciously attacked for those positions. The fact that he was Jewish was not an armor plating that allowed him to escape it. So you're going to get attacked one way or the other.
You're listening to the interview on the World Service of the BBC with Owen Bennett-Jones and my guest today, Professor Mearsheimer of the University of Chicago and Professor Stephen Walt of Harvard University. They've written a book about the Israel lobby in America. I say Israel lobby, you say Israel lobby, and a lot of people use the phrase Jewish lobby. What's the distinction?
Well, it's not a Jewish lobby because not all American Jews are in the lobby. In fact, if you look at survey data on the American Jewish community, roughly one-third of American Jews feel no serious attachment to Israel. And furthermore, many American Jews who do feel an attachment to Israel reject the policies that the lobby pushes. So it's not a case that all Jews belong to the lobby. And furthermore, one of the most powerful components of the lobby are the Christian Zionists. And the Christian Zionists certainly are not Jewish. And by the way, many neoconservatives, people like James Woolsey and John Bolton, are not Jewish. People sometimes say that when you use the word neoconservatives, it's synonymous with Jews, but that's not the case at all.
Right. Let's get down to details. One of the big claims in your book, and one of the most controversial, was that Israel influenced the U.S. decision to go to war in Iraq. I'll read the quote. Pressure from Israel and the lobby was not the only factor behind the decision to attack Iraq in March 2003, but it was critical. And you even go as far, I think, as saying, if it wasn't for the Israeli pressure, it might not have happened. Might not have happened. Now, I've read the chapter in your book on this issue, and I don't think you really stand that up. What's the evidence that that's true?
Well, first of all, there is a massive amount of evidence that Israel was pushing the United States between early 2002 and March 2003 to invade Iraq. So there's no question that Israel was pushing us. Second, there's no question that the lobby was pushing us. Now that the war in Iraq has gone south, some of Israel's supporters say that the lobby was not pushing for a war in Iraq. But that's simply not true, and we provide lots of evidence. So here you have a lobby that, by all accounts, is extremely powerful, right? Pushing a war against Iraq. it has to be the case that it's having some influence. Now, that's
a circular argument. You're saying it's powerful, it's pressing, therefore it won. So we can
I said therefore it had to have some influence. Mm. So then the question becomes, who else was pushing for this war? Many people like to say the oil companies were. That's not true. Many people like to say the oil-producing states were. That's not true. Certainly, Arab Americans were not pushing for this war. There was significant resistance within the State Department, within the uniformed military, and within the intelligence community. Right? Now, there's no question that you could not have this war without President Bush and Vice President Cheney being on board. In fact, they were the ultimate decision makers. Without them, you would not have had a war. That's why we do not argue for one second that Israel and the lobby alone caused this war. Our argument is that they were a powerful force pushing for the war.
But my problem is this, that to establish that, surely you would have to provide evidence that President Bush and Vice President Cheney considered were presented with the arguments of the lobby, considered them, and then on that basis made the decision. And that evidence isn't there, is it?
We don't have President Bush telling us that, but I just remind you, who thought up the idea of invading Iraq, toppling Saddam Hussein? That idea was invented by the neoconservatives, right, in the late 1990s. They began pushing this in early 1998 with two letters to President Clinton, right, and pushed it steadily right up through 2003 when the war occurred. The neoconservatives in the Project for New American Century, many of whom are connected to key organizations in the lobby, like the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. So first of all, without them thinking up this whole idea, you don't get a war. They were not able to persuade Clinton, and they were not able to persuade Bush in the first 9 months of his presidency. They're still pushing. We know that from a number of sources, but Bush doesn't buy it. September 11th is critical. Changes the calculations of Bush and Cheney in a number of ways, and the neoconservatives are there with a prescription for what needs to be done.
Point taken entirely. And the neoconservatives are obviously a very important element of this decision. However, I don't buy your argument that they are necessarily part of the Israeli lobby. I mean, these are people who have views. They think they are acting in American interests. They have strong views, but some of them are
Everyone in the Israeli lobby thinks they're acting in America's interests.
We don't contest that.
What's the connection between, let's say, John Bolton and the Israeli lobby?
John Bolton is closely associated with the American Enterprise Institute and a handful of other organizations
in the Israeli lobby.
He's been a fellow there in the past. He's worked there. That paid his salary.
Paul Wolfowitz has just moved to the American Enterprise Institute. We have a lengthy discussion in the book of the close relationships between the neoconservatives and main institutions in the lobby. The idea that there's this big divide between the neoconservatives and the institutions in the lobby is simply not the case.
Just for explanation's sake, can you just talk us through some of these institutions, because they're important in this whole story as to what they are, what they do?
Well, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which was set up by people from AIPAC as a think tank, a pro-Israel think tank in Washington. The American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, the most visible part of the lobby in Washington.
And probably the most powerful.
Right. The Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, which is a think tank in Washington that's heavily interested in Middle East policy, very pro-Israeli, very hawkish as well. The Project for a New American Century, which is another think tank that produced a number of these things. The publication, The Weekly Standard, where a number of these individuals are on their board or are contributing writers to it. This is an interlocking set of organizations.
Yeah, but my point is this. To establish your case, surely you have to show, in the case of the neoconservatives, that they were influenced by Israel. You have to show that they went to Israel, that they met Israeli officials, that Israeli officials persuaded them of certain positions. Don't you have to show that?
No, I think you've misunderstood the argument. We make it clear in the book that Israel did not conceive of the war in Iraq. They didn't think this up in Jerusalem and then sell it to the Americans. It was the neoconservatives in Washington who thought up the war, and they actually had to sell it to the Israelis. The Israelis were more worried about Iran. And in the fall of 2001, they were somewhat scared. When they first heard about us going after Iraq, they actually wanted us to do Iran first. The neocons had to persuade them that they were going to do Baghdad first and then put pressure on Iran.
Right. So it's almost like the neocons sold this to Israel.
That's what I just said.
Yeah. Well, in that case, they're not part of the lobby, are they?
that who's not part of the lobby?
The neocons. They're sort of persuading Israel. It's not a question of Israel persuading Washington. It's some people in Washington persuading Israel.
But we're not making the argument that Israel always tells the lobby what to do, and then the lobby does it. It is possible that the lobby itself can come up with a policy prescription, right, that is in Israel's interest, but Israel doesn't think up. And this is basically what happened here.
Right. This is quite an important point, because you're now sort of saying that the lobby is almost an independent group.
Sometimes it is.
It's an American interest group. It's not an international conspiracy. It's not something where it takes its orders from Jerusalem. It's not anything like that. It's an American interest group that, we argue in the book, often recommends policies that are not in Israel's interest and that even some Israelis disagree with.
But no, you make the argument that sometimes America does things which are more in Israel's interest than America's own interests. I mean, we started off with that in this interview.
Sometimes that's the case, and sometimes it's the case that it's in neither country's interests.
The Iraq War being a perfect example of that. It's been bad for the United States, but also bad for Israel, because it's improved Iran's strategic position and created a failed state in Israel's neighborhood.
And the same
very
thing,
bad for Israel.
And the same thing was true during the Lebanon War.
Let me close this sort of section by just asking you to respond to this more generalized way of putting this point, that there are people in America who have strong views which may benefit Israel, may benefit America, but they are independently arrived at. They are their own views. They're the product of American culture and history, if you like. And therefore, there's nothing particularly exceptional about them going and performing as public officials do and trying to get what they think should be done.
There's no question about that. But our point is that any individual or group of individuals who feels a deep attachment to another country is going to think about what is best for the United States in ways that are shaped somewhat by his or her feelings towards that other country. If you're an American of Chinese origin and you feel a deep attachment to China, how you think about U.S. policy towards China is undoubtedly going to be affected by your attachment to China. There is nothing wrong with this. But there is also nothing wrong with us pointing out that that particular person, be he or she Chinese or Jewish or a Christian Zionist, has a certain attachment and is probably going to think about American policy in ways that are influenced by that attachment. That's our argument here.
What do you think it does in Congress? Tell us how that works, the mechanism.
The AIPAC is a formal lobbying organization. It's designed primarily to sit on Capitol Hill and directly influence what congressmen do. It helps them draft legislation when it's time to write a bill that might affect Israel. It provides information to congressmen. AIPAC has a representative in every congressman's district that gets to know the congressman so that their views can be represented. AIPAC interviews every candidate for Congress who's thinking about running and asks them to write a position paper so that AIPAC knows. And then finally, although AIPAC is forbidden by law from giving money directly to congressional campaigns, what AIPAC does is takes what it finds out about candidates and helps steer money from political action committees. Just to give you a sense of the magnitude, political action committees are groups formed in the United States to provide money to candidates running for office. It's a way of getting around various campaign finance
laws. What sort of quantities are we talking?
Well, the pro-Israel PACs, of which there are about three dozen, have given $55 million since 1992 to various campaigners for office. That's not individual contributions. That's just through these political action committees. By comparison, Arab American groups, same period, $800,000. $55 million versus $800,000.
And one of your points is that if you're critical of Israel, or not supportive, actually, then your opponent...
That money disappears from your account and it will go to your opponent.
Do you ever regret writing a book? All the trouble? All the controversy?
Not at all.
None at all. We think it is very important that people in the United States and people in Europe talk openly about Israeli policy, the U.S.-Israeli relationship, and the role of the lobby in formulating U.S. Middle East policy. And that's why we wrote the book.
There's an interesting article in the Israeli press saying that your book was a sign that Israel should be careful not to overplay its hand, and that there was a risk of there being a backlash to the strength of the lobby. Do you think that's right?
I'd put it slightly differently. I don't think there will be a backlash. I think if the United States had a more normal relationship with Israel, that would be good for both countries. The fact is, right now, the United States is not a very good ally to Israel because we give them such uncritical support. So we actually think we'd be a better friend to Israel if we had a more normal relationship and if Americans could have a more open discussion of the different forces shaping our policy.
You're going to Israel, I think, in a few months, aren't you?
Yes, we hope to go in the spring. We've been treated very well in Israel. The single best review that we have received came from Yuri Avnery, who is an Israeli. And in Haaretz, we have had three reviews.
That's a newspaper in Israel.
Haaretz is effectively the New York Times of Israel. We have had three reviews in Haaretz that have said positive things, if not very positive things, about our book.
It is actually an irony, possibly, that the debate in Israel is actually more open than the debate in America.
Absolutely. The Israelis are all over the map on this issue. They have a very active debate on their own policy and sometimes on their relationship with the United States. And if we could have that kind of a discussion in the United States, we'd end up with policies that were better for both countries.
You don't think it's worked out terribly well in what they do, but you actually rather admire the Israeli lobby for their effectiveness?
It's a very impressive operation. There's no question about that. One of the points we make in the conclusion, in fact, is that we think there would be nothing wrong with having a very influential pro-Israel lobby in the United States if that lobby were using its influence for a better set of policies. It's not the fact that it's so powerful. It's the fact that many of the policies it's endorsed have been quite wrong-headed.
Professor Walton, Professor Mearsheimer, thank you very much for talking to us on the interview.
Thank you for having us here.
It's been a pleasure.
And for full details of our huge new range of audio for free download or podcast and our terms of use, just go to bbcworldservice.com/podcast.